Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. And today we've got a special guest all the way from the UK, Mr. Steve Rodford. You guys are the AOR aficionados out there will know him from the band Rio in the mid-80s. But he's also been playing with the legendary 60s act, the Zombies, for the last 25 years or so. So we're going to talk about all that stuff today. But Steve, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, guys. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, same here. Thank you for giving us a few minutes today.
Sorry about all the technical issues earlier.
No problem. It happens a lot, you know, no big deal.
Yeah.
That's what we have editing for, right?
Exactly.
But let's start with, we told you we're going to talk about a little bit of everything, your whole career today, but Tom and I and our crowd, a big part of our audience is basically into melodic rock and hard rock, AOR, all that stuff from the 80s and everything. So people who are watching this and know the band Rio, you guys released two albums back in the mid 80s. The first one being Borderline. Let's talk
Borderland.
Borderland. I'm sorry about that.
Sorry.
Borderland. Thank you for correcting me. And
that's okay.
But let's go a little bit before that. I wanted to talk to you about the Bombay band. It was a 7-inch single that was released with two tracks, which I guess that was sort of the nucleus or the genesis beginnings of Rio, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we got signed and that was the name we liked. The reason we changed it in the end was because there was another band in the States called Bombay. Oh. So we had to change it. But that was our first release on Music for Nations, who signed us. And they did us on a subsidiary label called Food for Thought. And that came out and it did well, actually. We got we were on Radio 1 and everything with that. And then we got an album deal. So that's how we got to make Borderland.
Mm, okay.
So, so that was the first single. Terry Thomas was involved with that, who helped produce it. And we did it at Livingston Studios, which is where I met John, actually, back in the day. Ah. It was totally weird how we met. Totally meant to be. And but we started off like everybody does, you know, just making demos. We met and we hit it off. He did everything I didn't do. I mean, I played drums and bass on the records and keyboards. And he was a great singer. Mm. And a great guitar player.
Well, your dad even joined in on that first Bombay
release.
He
did. It's funny. I just put, I think, Bass by Jim on the cover of that record because I didn't want people to think I'm using my dad's name. You know, like, oh, we got Jim Rodford on it. Yeah. He's a complete legend, obviously. Wonderful having him on that. So, yeah. But I played bass on Borderland. I did all the bass on that record.
Okay. Right.
So, yeah.
That debut Rio album. I, you know, if we're the people watching us that are the AOR guys and the AOR aficionados, that's like a classic album. And I know,
oh, that's great.
Yeah. And Tom and I were just talking about it. You had some stuff you wanted to.
Yeah. One of my, believe it or not, in terms of AOR, and then it's been really, I'm being very truthful, one of my all time favorite albums. And I still play the album occasionally.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Have you heard the remastered new version? I think it sounds better.
I have it right here.
Yes.
Okay.
Right here.
Yeah. Great. Oh, that's wonderful.
So I wanted to ask you how this album came about and how you developed this style. Like, I mean, there was a lot of hard rock in Britain and the States at the time, a lot of metal. This was a very melodic, AOR-ish album. How did you guys develop that style and your songwriting and how that album all came about?
So, I mean, we started off when we first met John, I was working with a guy called Dave Kilminster, who that was at the end of another band, who's now with Roger Waters. You know, that he's quite famous now, Dave.
Yeah, I know the name.
And we were doing demos at my place and we needed a singer. So we found John by chance. And then Dave started doing other things. So me and John just started working together, doing demos. And in the end, the demos were getting so good that we got signed. It took out a long story short. But the record company loved the demo so much that they said, well, we want you, just you two, to make it. We want you to stay with the same method. So it was just the two of us, the whole record. So we just put it together. It was almost like, we didn't have a band.
Yeah.
Being a drummer, I did the drums. In fact, interestingly, I did the drums last on that record in London. So we tracked the whole album, and then I played drums to the whole thing with the whole thing happening in my headphones.
Wow.
But we spent about a year putting that together. So there's probably 20 tracks of backing vocals. They're all John. He's doing like 4 or 5-part harmonies, and each harmony's got like 4 vocals, which is one of my favorite elements of the album, actually, is all those backing vocals.
Yeah.
And I guess as well, it was a product of what we were into at the time. We love Foreigner, we love Journey. I can't think of any others off the top of my head, but okay. Yeah.
We actually spoke about that off the air, like if a lot of your influences might have been that USA melodic scene at
definitely.
The time. Boston,
definitely.
Styx,
Journey. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Massive influence. And we wanted to sound like that. And John... I mean, John's the main writer, but we co-wrote it. Yeah, I mean, I came up with a lot of the initial ideas as well. So it's very much a 50-50 thing. But again, we just did it, the two of us. And then we finished it off in London. And then we carried on the same way for the second album. But of course, not having the big success that we hoped for with the first album, and we actually got signed to Elektra, I think, with the first record.
Mm.
But then it just got lost. I think Poison had a big album and... we just got lost. We didn't get the. You can't blame the record company. But we didn't have the hit, and then the second album we didn't have the budget, and it's one of those stories, you know. And then it just came to an end.
Yeah. Now, with the first record, did you put together a band and tour that at all?
We did after the event. I mean, we did the whole record just the two of us, and then we had a band, which was a bit of a mistake because it was all very. After the event, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And we only did a handful of gigs and it never really went anywhere. John wasn't naturally, he wasn't very happy being the front man, I must say, on a gig situation. But it was just more of a studio project, I guess.
Mm.
But for the second album, we did try to pretend it was a band. We came up with some names for the album cover. So we had a drummer and a keyboard player, different names.
Right.
But it was actually me.
Right.
And we thought maybe that put people off. Fact it wasn't a real band, you know, but it was the technology had come in and we could make records ourselves at home, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the product of that, really. Wow. But which is so nice that it's so people still love it, actually.
The first album was I don't know, so maybe you can fill me in. How did that album sell? Did it meet expectations, or like
I don't really think it got the no I mean we got good airplay in America, I remember, in certain areas. But I don't remember. I never saw figures, but I don't think it just didn't catch fire, you know.
Because it was kind of an underground, at least in the States, yeah. It was kind of an underground, you know, album in sense that guys that were in the know knew how to pick it out of the bin and say, this is good, but like it didn't jump out at when you walked into a record. So it basically was like an underground classic, even from its inception.
Right. Sure. And of course, we didn't have a hit single. That would have probably made the big difference.
Which is incredible because there were probably 3, if not 4 or 5 songs that had a hit single. I was going to ask you about like Straight to the Heart, Tommy Can't Help It, State of Emergency. Those are 3 songs that really could have fit in USA radio. There's other songs, but those are the 3 that I could immediately think should have been single hits.
Yeah. There's a new mix of I Don't Want to Be the Fool on the new CD, which is I did a mix myself before Stefan Galfus got involved, and he helped mix it for that was to do with Elektra getting involved, that's right. But I did a mix, and it's much more like REO Speedwagon, and I think it could have been a hit. There's a new mix, my mix of it. It's bigger, and the drums sound more natural. So I thought that could have been a hit, but there you go.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of them, isn't it?
Now, on the second album, there was, at least from my ears, and I think Mark agrees with me, the second album, there was a more of a hard rock approach.
We were harder. That's right. Yeah.
Was that intentional, or was it just kind of grew out of where you were at?
I think it was as well. And I think it was a little bit of the frustration of, I think had Borderland been the success, then we would have carried on with that sound, I think.
Okay.
But then both of us are really into the harder stuff as well. And it's just the way we were writing at the time. Once we got to that second album. Yeah. It's got to put yourself back there. Yeah.
Well, I think about like the music, and Tom and I were talking about this before we came on air with you. We were trying to pinpoint like the Rio sound, because we think about bands in America at the time. You had like the Survivors and the Journeys, and you could talk to Foreigners and stuff like that. But there was this thing in the UK and in Britain where you had bands like an Air Race or Virginia Woolf, Rio. They had this sort of sound. And it was like, I guess you could call it AOR, but, and Tom has mentioned this before on other episodes we've had in the past talking with artists, where there's not like, was AOR a thing in your mind at that time that say, hey, we're making this type of music? Or were you just, like you said, chasing kind of the American arena rock sound or whatever?
I mean, I wouldn't say we were consciously chasing it. And I don't know whether the term was really bandied about then, was it? I don't know. I don't think we consciously were trying to fit anything, but we just loved being able to have that many harmonies, and we just thought it sounded better, you know, bigger.
Yeah.
Big loads of keyboards, and I guess it was our taste, actually. Yeah. It just happened to fit that mold, you know.
Yeah,
we liked it to sound that way.
We said that before we went on the air, we were talking about, you know, and I said, I honestly, from my recollection from that era, I don't even think the term AOR was really used. It kind of like...
I don't think it was.
Right. No. It kind of was like something that grew more like maybe into the late 80s, into the 90s, and is carried on now as a way to identify that sound. But I think back then we didn't even really use that term or put bands in that category, really.
It's pigeonholing things, isn't it? Right. Know, this is, you know... but I think we were just following our noses. Yeah. We were just a rock band, and we, in the studio, you can... It's like an instrument, isn't it? I love being our age, because by the time we had our own record deal, we had our own little studio. We had a 16 track. We did it all on 16 track. And we could just make this music, you know, a bit like Tom's Boston guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Tom, he did it all himself, didn't he? You know,
he
did it all at home.
I mean, that guy was an innovator in so many, and now we look back at that, with really his biggest innovation was making records at home before anybody even thought of, you know, of doing
that's
that.
That's right. Exactly that. Yeah, yeah. And we were just trying, again, we couldn't do drums at home, so we did it all. And then I put the real drums on last, which is quite unusual.
Yeah,
And it's like, no pressure. Okay, if I don't pull this off, we're fucked, you know? but it was fine. It was great. And it was amazing playing drums to a finished record.
Yeah.
Like, all the harmonies and everything. So, yeah.
Now, what was your feelings on that second record as compared to the first?
I mean, it was a little bit more throwaway to us. We didn't have the budget. We didn't spend the time on it. It was almost not obligation. We had the songs, and I actually prefer some of the demos for that record. It was a bit, I don't know. We didn't have the time. We spent a year on Borderland, and we probably spent, a couple of months on that one, the second one, but I still think there's some really good songs on there, actually. You know, but it's just
the middle of the record has a couple of terrific songs. You know, it's like one of those records. It's hard to compare it to the first, because in my ears, the first album was like utter perfection. So
beautiful.
The second album, you could hear that maybe there wasn't enough time put in the songwriting, wasn't enough budget in the studio. But there were hints of songs that were as good as the first album. But as far as how it flowed, you know, it was tough to compare it to that first album, because you know, you capture magic sometimes, and it's not really that easy to recapture it.
Yeah, no, that's right. And they often say, don't they, with your first album, you've had all that time before you get a record deal. You've got all these songs,
right,
and you can pick out your best 10 songs. And then the second record, although I still think there's some good stuff on there.
Oh, but there is. It's far from a bad record. I think it just gets compared to that first record a lot, and it's looked at as like the stepchild of the first album.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Now, is there any truth in the matter that there was another project after that called, I believe, Backtalk?
Oh my God, you know your stuff. So there was a thing called Big Talk.
Big Talk, okay.
That's right, and that was us becoming a lot more 80s. with the technology. Again, it was just me and John, but we were going for a much more, I don't know, we weren't trying to be a rock band sounding, I don't know why really. It was just, we were experimenting, I guess. And the Rio thing had come to an end. Yeah, there was a couple, there's another thing called Shaking Tree we did, me and John. We never stopped doing things, actually. We're still doing things together now.
Now, when you say technology-wise, you said, what did the Big Talk, what was it sounding like? What type of style?
So it was more sort of, not, I wouldn't say machine-y, but more big. There's a track called Black Box, which is huge. Still the same, like loads of BVs, but doing more, there's more synths, actually, okay. More synthesizers and production in that way, you okay. know.
More but, of like a Depeche Mode type of sound?
Kind of, maybe, yeah, more sort of the big machine-y drums, you know.
Ultravox, which were very much like that type of?
I guess could have been, yeah, that kind of
thing. That's interesting.
Thing.
Now, is this an album that was finished or is it?
No, we didn't get signed. We nearly got signed. We had interest. And there's a handful of demos which are of leaks out of God knows how. Some of them turned up somewhere in the world. I can't remember. And they would have only gone out to record companies on cassette. So I can't believe they exist. But there was talk of the Melodic Rock Classics releasing some of those demos as a third release. But they haven't got back to us lately, so... But maybe they'll surface. But some of them are good. Again, it's different to Borderland, but it's still me and John, and it's still good. Hopefully, good songwriting, you know, yeah. And some good musical ideas.
There's enough there to put out. There's like an album's worth of material.
No. And then we were writing for other people sometimes, and there's one track we've done called Dangerous, which has got a great sax player on it, which again is very different. You know, we sort of explored different avenues, I suppose. But it's, I guess we just thought, had Borderland done well and we'd had a bit of a hit with it, I think we would have had the spirit to carry on with it, you know.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit about, you mentioned the Melodic Rock Classics reissues that came out of the first two albums. Tell us in your own words a little bit about that second album, which was obviously originally entitled Sex Crimes. But changed to Danger Zone and, you know, reworked artwork and stuff. Tell us a little bit about how that all came about.
So, yeah, so we once we'd done all the Borderland stuff, we'd gone through all the masters and got it remastered and what have you, and the extra tracks, we started looking at Sex Crimes. And it was like, that cover was always such an embarrassment. You know, it's shit. Yeah. It's so tacky. And the story with that was we went to the record company and they said, oh, this is the cover we've done. And we went, we hate it. They said, well, we haven't got any more budget. That's got to be it. I mean, that's how it was just like, okay, this just, you know, and the sound of it, I couldn't believe how bad it sounded. So just the mastering and just very thin.
It had
thin,
a very weird drum sound. I was talking to Mark about it. It had a very strange drum sound. The second album.
Again, we didn't have the budget and I didn't play on that album. We just left the programming.
Okay.
So
there you go.
And we had another engineer, and again, it was no budget, no time.
Okay.
Now
I understand it was programmed drums. That's why.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. Whereas Borderland is, I'm actually playing those, you know. Although some of the mixes, Stefan makes them sound a bit programmed, but then that was kind of the fashion.
Yes,
you know, you make the drums sound really.
Yes.
Electronic sounding, yes. Yeah.
85 was a big year for those type of drums.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember Gary Moore, who's one of my all-time favorites, actually used those drums on one of his albums around that time. And I wasn't wild about it, but it was like something that everybody, especially in the UK, a lot of bands were using that drum sound. It became very in vogue.
Yeah, exactly. So we stuck with that. But again, the demos, some of the demos are better, actually.
Really?
I'll send you a couple.
Yeah, I'd love that.
So you can compare it. Yeah, we just did ourselves. What are we talking about? So that album, yeah. So there we are. It was just that it was more quickly done, didn't have the time, and just we felt a bit depressed, really, you know, like the first album, and we felt had done nothing. And that explains that, I guess.
How did you arrive with the Melodic Rock Classics reissue with the new title, retitling it? We know you didn't like the name, but you also did, you know, obviously the artwork too. Kind of, you righted it wrong, right?
Yes, exactly that. And I've the sleeve notes on the, I still haven't got a copy actually of Danger Zone, but we always hated I mean, Sex Crimes, the song, is pretty cool, actually. It's quite a good song. But I always thought Danger Zone was a much better song and title. So it was lovely to readdress that. And the artwork, I thought, was awful.
Well, I could tell you as a fan and interacting with other fans back in the day when this album came out, nobody could get that album cover. Nobody was like, everything was like, what the fuck? With this album cover.
We were the same.
Yeah.
What the fuck? This is terrible.
Yeah. It was always like a point of like interest, like with people, like you'd interact with people and they'd say, never get what that album cover is about, but whatever.
Oh, man, that's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we were the same. So that's been the beautiful thing about a reissue is like we can correct that, you know.
Yeah.
And make it does sound better. We've had it remastered.
Were you ever given an explanation as to what that actually meant or signified with
what their concept was?
What the concept was of that picture?
No, not really.
Because to this day, I can't really figure it out. I mean,
no, it's some kind of, is it some kind of bondage thing?
And it's like some androgynous. I guess in today's day and age, it kind of goes over more so than it did in 1985. You know, it looks like a possible transitioning of sorts, but with wings.
Yeah, exactly.
A wing transitioner.
Yeah, I guess they just went ahead with their art department, and as I say, we went up there and we said, "Well, we hate this.
Department, yeah,
this is shit." And they said, "Well, we haven't got the budget. We're gonna have to go with it." And it's like, "Oh, really?" So after that, we just kind of almost wanted to forget about that album, really. It was just like, oh, well, fuck it.
It's always been a strange follow-up for it. And I think, actually, the cover sandbagged it with a lot of people because it was a change in sound. Not that it was like a dramatic change in sound, but I think the cover just kind of made it seem like almost it was like a different band. You know?
Yes, because there's me and John on the first album, right? So, there's an identity to it. Like, what the fuck is this? Yeah.
Now, you had some involvement on the second album with an artist that I was a big fan of, and Marcus too, John Verity. Terrific. Another guy, totally unknown, but that's put out some great records. And
Before we did Borderland, me and John, we toured in John's band. And I don't know if you're aware that John Verity joined Argent, which is
I knew that.
Yeah, you know that. Yeah, so that's how I met John. And then I played drums for John.
Okay.
And I did about two or three albums with him, maybe more over the years, actually. And John Willoughby came on tour with us. Sorry, John Neal is his stage name. But John Willoughby is his real name.
Okay, right.
As indicated on Bombay.
Right, it's on the Bombay.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So I guess we were trying to go even bigger with the backing vocals. In fact, interestingly, right, let's just go back, right, before Bombay, the guy I told you about, Dave Kilminster, and me and John Willoughby, Neil, and Dave Kilminster went into the Livingston Studios with John Verity engineering us. And we recorded a track called Don't Look Back. And John did all the backing vocals, John Verity.
Wow.
And it sounds fucking massive. And the Kinks management, my dad was with the Kinks at the time, took it all the way to New York at Geffen. He was convinced we were going to get signed with this thing, and we didn't. Mm. But that was almost like Rio with Dave Kilminster on guitar.
Wow.
And John Verity on vocals. Mm. It was fucking massive.
Wow.
I mean, I've got a demo on cassette. Maybe I'll send you that.
I'd love to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. It still sounds. I mean, Dad's on bass. That's right.
Really?
But Dad's on bass. Yeah. Yeah. He came in and played it. We did the backing track live. And then we sat there and John V did all the BVs and it was fucking huge.
Wow.
So with Borderland, we wanted a sound like that. But we just did it ourselves. So John Willoughby did all the thing. And then for Sex Crimes, getting confused with the names here, Danger Zone, we went to Trident and we had a day where John and John did the backing vocals together. So we just thought, let's go even bigger with the backing vocals.
Mm.
So yeah, there we are.
Wow.
So that's the story there, yeah. He sounds great.
Before we move on to the Zombies, Would we be looking forward to to any type of Rio music coming out in the near future?
I mean, we've probably got an EP's worth recorded. The last one we did, Long Way From Home, which is on YouTube, actually. If you go Long Way From Home, Rio.
Really?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. No one's seen it, but we made the video ourselves. We're not in it. Long Way From Home. We really love the song. Again, it's what we're doing now, you know. But we recorded it all ourselves because I can record my real drums myself now.
Mm.
You know, I've got all the gear and everything. But I don't know about release. I don't think Melodic Rock Classics are interested in anything new, as far as I can gather. They're more into re-releasing old albums, aren't they?
Yeah.
But if we can get some interest, but we've just not even thought about it, really. There's Free the Love is not out anywhere, but that's a really good song. What else? I think we've got three or four that we've actually got finished. So, yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
But again, you know, I've been so busy, I mean, with the Zombies, and now I'm playing with Colin Bluntstone's band.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
So we're like weekend recorders, me and John. If we fancy it, we get together and do a bit, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Okay. Well,
there's one thing I wanted to ask you before we get to the Zombies talk. I wanted to ask you, I noticed that you co-wrote a song with John Payne of Asia fame called Obsession.
Yes.
And it appeared on of the archive albums that Asia put out in that period.
Yes.
What was your connection and what's your connection with John?
So John, I knew him since he lived in my town or the next town. I knew him. He was a couple of years older than me, but he was always around and I knew him and friends of his. And I think he was working with Jeff Downes and he came to my studio and I played him the demo of that. And he said, I could come up with something for that. And I'd got the whole track already recorded. I played everything on it because I play guitar as well as and keys. And that's how it came about. Mm. And me and John both prefer the demo. but they did it on Aqua, did they? No, not Aqua. What was the album?
I know it was on one of the archive albums. They had the two volume, but it might have been on, it was on one of the other albums too.
I'm not sure, It was on the archive album. Yeah.
It's like I've written like that with guys before where I do demos where I've done all this music and I haven't got a song, but I've just got music.
Right.
And then someone will go, oh, I could write some lyrics to that. And then it becomes a co-write, you know, and that's what happened there. I think he literally just sang over my demo.
Oh, okay. Well, because Tom and I had Harry Whitley on our podcast recently, who is the new singer with Asia.
Oh, I don't know him. Okay.
Right. But we were talking about this in the podcast because, you know, a lot of people don't give that credit to the John Payne era of Asia.
Yeah.
You know, almost like, and it lasted so long. I mean, there was so many albums that came out. And it's like everybody just thinks of the, you know, the original Asia and the reunion in 2008. But, you know, no one talks about that John Payne era. And I happen to notice that you had that co-write. So I was always curious about that.
I'm impressed with your knowledge, guys.
Thank you.
We can't prepare, Steve.
You do, man. I'm professionals.
There you go. You could call us that, right? I mean,
yeah. But that's interesting about Obsession. Yeah, I'd forgotten all about that song.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
So you wanted to, let's talk about it. It's been the better part of 25 years now, right? That you've been playing with the Zombies. I mean, a band from the 60s, right? I mean, everybody knows those songs. Time of the Season, She's Not There. Yeah. I mean, ultra classics, AM radio throughout America, huge songs. How did you kind of get involved with that 25 years or so ago?
Well, obviously, the massive connection there is, there's no reason I got in the band, but my dad, you know, being a bass player, right?
Yeah.
When that band came up, it was Colin that had a solo band. It got back on the road. And I worked with Colin, with Keith Airy and Bob Ski. I had a band called Third Stone, which is a great band, actually. Like a power three piece, a bit Zeppelin, a bit Hendrix. But anyway, we were called in as a group to do a couple of tracks on Colin's solo album. This was totally separate and before the Zombies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd met Colin. I mean, obviously I knew him anyway. He was a family friend, what have you. And then when Colin rang up Rod and said, look, I've got six gigs. I'm sick of all these debt musicians. Would you just help me do these six gigs? And Rod said, oh, I don't know. Because he remembers the 70s with touring and massive PAs and big trucks and everything. And my dad said, look, no, it's not like that anymore, Rod. Come and just... Anyway, so they said, who are we going to get on drums? And Rod had never heard me play, even though he's my dad's cousin, he's my second cousin. But Colin said, well, what about Steve? And my dad said, well, yeah. But I mean, my dad, being my dad, he wouldn't have put me up for it because it's nepotism. You know, it's like, I'll get my boy in, you know.
Right. Yeah.
But it was Colin that suggested me. And then when we started... basically, Rod had such fun doing those six gigs. It turned into 25 years and records and what have you. And it wasn't called The Zombies to start with. It was Rod Argent, Colin Bluntstone, and their all-star band.
Ah.
And so we were playing Zombie stuff, Argent stuff, Colin Bluntstone solo stuff. And in a lot of ways, I love those early days. A, it was with my dad. We had Mark Johns on guitar. And then after Mark left, after about a year, Keith Airy, the guy from Third Stone, my band, or his band, he joined. So we had me, Keith Airy, my dad, Rod, and Colin. And we did, and then the whole thing started to grow. And then promoters, after 2 or 3 years, said, well, why don't we call it The Zombies? Because it's the two main guys. But that wasn't, it wasn't getting The Zombies back together. It was a natural process of, well, why don't we just call it that then? It's easier for the audience to know who's in the band. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
So it was a very natural start, yeah. And then Rod started writing and we started recording and it turned into all this. It's just been an amazing, especially now it's over. It's looking back, it's all the more precious. And I'm so proud of what we did, you know, and we did some amazing shows and tours, played with Tom Petty and all sorts of great bands. Anyway, yeah.
No, I mean, 25 years almost. That's a huge part of your life and your career.
Really? I was 38 when I joined the band. I'm 62 now.
Yeah.
It's like, fucking hell. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, and Rod's a genius. And Colin's one of the best singers, you know. And it was like family. I mean, we were all pretty much, as I say, my dad and Rod were cousins. They grew up together.
Yeah, wow.
And obviously that was the whole Argent story. I used to watch Argent when I was like 9 years old. I'd watch them rehearse. So that was part of my upbringing, you know.
Wow.
So when I joined what was become The Zombies, I felt like I joined Argent.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wow, I'm playing with Rod,
right,
with Dad, and we're playing Argent songs, you know. In fact, we used to do quite a lot of Argent songs in the early days. So it was just amazing working with masters, you know?
Yeah.
Argent were big in the States for a while, like back in the day.
Yeah. I know Hold Your Head Up was top five.
Huge. That song was massive on US radio.
And we played that at every show for all the zombie shows for 25 years. We always finished. Hold Your Head Up was like, it was always in the set. Yeah. So I always loved playing that. And I was 11 when that was a hit in England. And it was just, wow, my dad's on Top of the Pops. He's in a fucking proper rock band. You know, it's so exciting.
Yeah.
To end up playing with them was just incredible.
Wow.
So, there's so many high spots. So go on, sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. No, I was going to say, so what's on the horizon for you now?
So luckily, especially with The Zombies finishing last year, I've been in Colin's solo band on and off for all the last few years. So now that is full steam ahead. You know, there's no other gigs. So we're coming out to the States in a month. We're doing the Legends of Rock cruise.
Oh, wow.
And then we're doing a few dates with Al Stewart in California, I think. I mean, I thought that was my trips to America over after The Zombies. But yeah, we're coming up. We've got about two tours this year.
Oh, wow.
We did four shows. Sorry, go on.
No. Say, when was the last time you were in the States with The Zombies?
So that would have been the last tour, last summer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, Legends of Rock, they'll be playing what parts of the country? I'd be interested in that.
Well, actually, no, that's the cruise.
That's the cruise.
Oh, it's a cruise. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's Alice Cooper, Jason Bonham's on it. Robin Trower. Can't wait to see him.
Oh, boy.
Robin
Trower is one of my childhood idols.
Oh, me too. Me too, man. Yeah, totally. And who did I see on one of the last cruises? Pat Travis.
Another one, yeah.
I love that, man.
Yeah.
And he had Jaco Pastorius' son on bass.
Really?
It was killer.
Really?
I thought, who's that? Fucking. Yeah, man. I think Jaco's got two sons and they both play bass.
I didn't know that.
Apparently. I didn't know that. And I was like, who's that bass player? He's amazing.
Really?
I said, oh, yeah, that's Jaco's son. Yeah.
And he plays in his. I didn't know that.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. He plays with Pat Travis.
I didn't know.
He's got this weird long thing coming out of the bottom of his chin. It's like a stud that's massive. And I thought, what the fuck?
Really?
And then I was interested. But then you watch him play and he's like, well, he's unbelievable. Wow. Yeah, so check him out. Yeah, I can't remember his name.
I got to look for that on YouTube. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and then we got Flower Power? Oh, no, On the Blue Cruise, which we've done for years. The Zombies used to do a lot of them. Mm-hmm. We did the first Moody Blues one, one of the first ones, and we stormed it. You know, I remember the boat was leaving Jamaica and we were playing Hold Your Head Up and the whole boat was shaking.
Yeah.
And we were just setting sail. It was a magical moment I'll never forget.
That's great.
And we won all the fans over. So from then on, we were like second on the bill on those cruises, the Moody Blues cruises. Yeah. So that was a good few years. That was great.
That's fantastic.
So we're doing that. Yeah.
We got to get you to come to the East Coast in the US here.
Yeah, yeah, I think we will be. I haven't got my diary with me. I think we're doing some, I think we're leaving from Boston on that cruise. So I think there might be some dates around it.
Oh, okay. Wow. Nice. Where can people keep up with you and with what you're doing now? Is there any kind of social media web pages you guys have?
I mean, I haven't got a personal one, but I mean, the Colin Bluntstone, you'll be able to just look him up.
Okay.
He's got an Instagram thing, and the Rocks Management are our management. So there'll be stuff there on their website, all the dates. But yeah, just Google Colin. I mean, all the dates will come up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll certainly plug that on our, in the closing credits of the episode here, and we'll put them some web links down and everything like that.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Anything else, Tom?
I'm good.
You're good? Well, Steve, hey, we appreciate your time today.
Good talking to you. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, same
pleasure,
here.
Pleasure, Steve.
We'll keep in touch.
Yeah, man, definitely. And if I'll get around to it, I'll send you a couple
of demos. Send me some of those songs. I'd love to hear them.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Great. Okay, appreciate it. Nice to meet you.
Great. Same here.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.